This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, November 22nd, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. After a week of impeachment testimony in the House, where do things stand? How does the case for impeachment stack up? Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute and author of the new Cato paper, Indispensable Remedy, The Broad Scope of the Constitution's Impeachment Power. We spoke this week about recent testimony in the House. Given the testimony of the ambassador to the European Union, how do you evaluate the impeachment proceedings as they have unfolded thus far?
Well, we've had about a week of public testimony, and I think it's done at least two things to set President Trump's defenders back on their heels. I think what testimony we've had has dramatically undermined the argument that there was no quid pro quo and it was a perfect call. We've had testimony from multiple National Security and State Department officials that at least a state visit by President Zelensky of the Ukraine and the release of the $391 million in military aid were conditioned on investigating Joe and Hunter Biden, or at least making a very public announcement of an investigation. And on top of that, the mere fact of the public impeachment inquiry has blown up some of the due process arguments that President Trump and some of his supporters were making initially. You remember, it was an impeachment inquiry in scare quotes because the full House hadn't voted and it was a kangaroo court and the president got less protection in due process terms than a serial killer. Well, all of that has been has to go by the wayside. The full House did vote to authorize an inquiry, and in that inquiry, the GOP has essentially the same rights that were granted to the minority party in the Nixon and Clinton inquiries. So I think we've had to go on to different defenses of what's at issue here.
So what did Gordon Sondland say, the Trump's European Union ambassador?
Well, he testified that there was an explicit quid pro quo with regard to at least the state visit by the president of the Ukraine. He said that everyone was in the loop on that, including Secretary of State Pompeo and Vice President Mike Pence. Sondland said that Trump never told him directly in so many words that delivery of the military aid was conditioned on announcing the Biden investigation. So there's no smoking gun or stained dress, as you had in the Nixon and Clinton inquiries. But we do know that the White House held up the aid. We don't have a good explanation for that, and that President Trump was personally very interested in getting an investigation of the Bidens. Sondland himself has some problems as a witness. He had to revise his earlier deposition to make it more consistent with the other testimony that was saying that the existence of that the aid was being used for leverage was widely understood within the officials working on within the community of officials working on this, and he is the first person with another one of the complaints that has been made by some of the Republicans on the committee is that, this is most of the people we've heard from have secondhand knowledge at best of from President Trump. They weren't in direct communication with him. Well, that's not true of Sondland. And so I think some of his testimony was pretty damaging. It's also given the fact that the reason you're not having more testimony from people who talk directly with President Trump is because President Trump has basically ordered them not to testify, including John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney. Sondland himself was testifying over Trump's objection. The idea that the caliber of witnesses is should undermine the inquiry. It's kind of like the old joke about killing your parents and throwing yourself on the mercy of the court as an orphan. The reason we haven't had as many firsthand fact witnesses in this inquiry is because President Trump is trying to prevent them from testifying.
And it's interesting. Some of the Republicans on the committee seemed to be in some ways trying to hold that against Ambassador Sondland, that his testimony was weak, that he presumed in some ways because he didn't have access to a lot of the papers that the State Department won't release.
Right. Well, it's never a good thing when you have to correct your testimony based on what other people have said. But yes, he did point out that he had difficulty otherwise refreshing his memory through contemporaneous documentation that the State Department was not releasing for to him. So, yeah, that's a problem.
So let's assume that Thursday morning, Adam Schiff's version of events is basically true. And the president did hold up this aid, this duly authorized aid by Congress, that it had met all of these requirements for having that aid released. And the president held it up in exchange for a very specific thing, which was an announcement on a major network by President Zelensky of Ukraine that he would be initiating investigations into the Bidens. Is that impeachable?
Well, impeachable offenses are in a broad category, and categories sort of summed up by Alexander Hamilton as abuse or violation of the public trust. And if you take what's alleged as true for the purposes of argument, the allegation is that President Trump used the powers of the office to pressure a foreign government to help his reelection campaign. And that is sort of right in the wheelhouse of impeachable offenses, misuse of official power for self-dealing, for corrupt purposes or personal gain. There's actually a fairly close parallel with one of the articles of impeachment that drove President Nixon from office. We usually think of Nixon as the paradigm of an impeachable president. And you always have to point out here that he wasn't technically impeached. He quit before the full House could vote. But the House Judiciary Committee did vote out three articles of impeachment. The second article that they voted on in July 1974 was focused on abuse of power. And the first item it listed was the Nixon administration's attempts to order up IRS investigations on political opponents, including people who worked for or supported his opponent in the 1972 presidential election, Senator George McGovern. You can draw a fairly tight comparison between what is alleged to what President Trump is alleged to have done and what Article 2 of the Nixon impeachment leads with.
The GOP defenses during Ambassador Sondland's testimony seemed, in some ways odd. Jim Jordan argued essentially because these things didn't occur, that is to say, the White House meeting with President Zelensky and Donald Trump, and the public announcement that there would be some sort of investigation of the Bidens on a major platform, and of course the aid itself was released. And people like Jim Jordan make the argument: there's nothing here, nothing has practically been altered. Everything has moved on swimmingly. So why are we even here talking about this?
Yeah, the argument is basically no harm, no foul. The aide got released. The announcement wasn't made. So, what's the big deal? To answer that, you know, I think that involves a factual question and a constitutional question. The factual question is what was behind the decision to release the aide? At the time that the White House releases it, the press is already onto the story that it may be being held up in order to force an investigation of the Bidens. And the White House is also aware that there's a whistleblower complaint out there. So President Zelensky of Ukraine ends up getting the aid and doesn't have to make the announcement because the scheme got exposed and imploded, it's not exactly what the president likes to call, President Trump likes to call, total exoneration. These are some of the factual questions that they're trying to unpack. As far as the legal constitutional question, that involves, you know, does an abuse of office actually have to be completed in order for it to be an impeachable offense, or do attempts at abuse of office count? And it seems to me that it's clear that attempts do count. If you go back to the Article 2 of the Nixon impeachment that I mentioned a moment ago, his attempt to, quote-unquote, screw his political enemies with IRS audits. Well, the audits that Nixon wanted didn't happen. His IRS commissioner wanted no part of it and just, refused to comply. It still leads off in the line items in the abuse of power article of impeachment that the House Judiciary Committee passed. So seems to me that's some indication that you don't have to wait until the abuse is actually completed to be talking about whether it's impeachable. You know, some of this line of argument gets actually embarrassing. There was a Wall Street Journal editorial at the end of October that was basically the argument was more or less that the president is too incompetent to pull off any high crimes. And it seems to me that's not, you know, really it's a bit of an embarrassing defense. I'm sure President Trump is not crazy about that line of argument, but it's also it's not very comforting because people can learn on the job. And if your best defense of the president is he tried to do something very wrong here, tried to abuse his office, but don't worry because, you know, people don't always listen to him and he'll generally screw it up anyway. But that's not it's not exactly an inspiring defense.
So what of the argument then from, and I believe I've heard Mick Mulvaney make this argument. I haven't heard Rand Paul make it, but I think he's made a similar assertion, which is quid pro quos with respect to foreign policy and foreign aid. These things happen all the time. How did Ambassador Sondland address that?
Well, I'm not sure he addressed that argument directly, but you know, Mulvaney and Rand Paul aren't exactly wrong that quid pro quos happen all the time. You know, it's not an abuse of office for the president to condition a state visit or foreign aid on, say, you know, opening foreign markets to U.S. goods and services, or for, you know, to condition it on intelligence sharing for counterterrorism purposes or things of that nature. You know, these are legitimate foreign policy goals. And if the president is using diplomatic powers as leverage to further those ends, you know, that's thought to be in the interest of the American people. But I think we'd all recognize that you get into the territory of self-dealing and illegitimate purposes. If, say, if we're talking about, you know, let's say on the call, it wasn't, you know, look into the Bidens. If it was, you know, you could help me out. If you could help me out with getting permitted for Trump Towers in Kiev, you know, I think we'd all say that's beyond the pale. The question is, you know, what is the Biden investigation request? Is that more like help us out with counterterrorism, or is it more like you know, help out my business or help out my reelection? So that's the answer to that seems pretty clear to me, but that's a decision people are going to have to make for themselves.
So if you were in place of Devin Nunes or Jim Jordan or one of these other Republicans on the committee that is taking this testimony, what would you be present as your best argument against impeachment?
Well, you know, I would stop digging. I wouldn't. I think a lot of the arguments have been pretty frivolous. The whistleblower's biased. That's really not relevant. Deep Throat, Mark Felt in the Nixon inquiry was biased. He'd been passed over for promotion. Linda Tripp, a whistleblower of sorts in the Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton impeachment, certainly had her own biases. That's really not at issue. That's, you know, what's at issue is what the president did. And I would definitely stop trying to echo the president's line that the call was perfect, or that you know, he was really just trying to drain the swamp in the Ukraine. It seems to me that doesn't really pass the straight face test. It's like saying, you know, Richard Nixon was really just interested in pursuing tax evasion when he ordered McGovern staffers audited. It seems to me the best argument, and I don't know if it would be useful if you're Devin Nunes, but the best arguments that I've seen made by some conservatives, I think Jonah Goldberg and Tim Carney have made this argument, is more of a prudential argument that the behavior shouldn't be defended. The request for investigation shouldn't be defended, but that there's a prudential argument against impeachment. Even if you I've seen people admit that this is at least arguably impeachable, but that the president shouldn't be impeached for it. We're 10, by the time it's all wrapped up, with the Senate trial, something like 10 months maybe from the next election. And I've seen people say that it should be, the closer you get to another election, the more you have another remedy that's less disruptive. And that whether or not it's an impeachable offense, the decision about whether to retain President Trump for another 4-year lease on the office is something that should be made at the ballot box rather than in an impeachment trial in the Senate. And, you know, there are arguments against that line of thinking, but it seems to me that unlike a lot of the other impeachment defenses that have been offered recently, it seems to me that this one is at least intellectually respectable.
Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute and author of the Cato paper, Indispensable Remedy, The Broad Scope of the Constitution's Impeachment Power. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please and follow us on Twitter @Cato Podcast.